Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's emotional plea today to the nation not to forget the recent massacre of children in Newtown and to turn the heartbreak into something real that will reduce gun violence. Saul Cornell, the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, joins us to discuss whether the Senate can be shamed into action on a watered-down gun control measure before it. Then we'll look into how the Saudis are offering young anti-government protesters who have been arrested a ticket out of jail if they go to Syria to fight in a jihad against the Assad regime. Freelance journalist Rhys Ehrlich, who has written an article at Global Post, Saudi Youth Fighting Against Assad Regime in Syria, joins us to explain the duplicity of the Saudi government in outsourcing the arming of Syrian rebels to wealthy Saudis who procure arms for the most radical fighters like the Al-Nusra Front. Then finally, we will examine the reversal of democracy in Thailand, Venezuela, the Philippines, Taiwan, and Russia with Joshua Kolancic, the author of a new book, Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government. He is a fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations and is a former columnist for Time and a correspondent for The New Republic, The American Prospect, and Mother Jones. And joining us now is Saul Cornell, who's the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect?, and the forthcoming book, The Second Amendment Goes to Court. He is the Paul and Diane Gunther Chair in American History at Fordham University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Saul Cornell.
Well, thank you for having me again.
And the president today made a very impassioned speech at the White House in front of the mothers of gun victims, and he reminded the nation that less than 100 days ago there was this horrible massacre in Newtown that the entire country pledged something would be done, and this time it would be different. And then he went president basically saying with indignation, shame on us if we've forgotten. I haven't forgotten those kids. Shame on us if we've forgotten. So is the country, does it have this kind of moral amnesia that the president's talking about?
Well, I would say that there are a couple things I would say, actually. First, it's a very diverse country. I think there are parts of the country where progress is being made and where the debate has changed so that we're now talking about this issue in a more deliberate, rational, and serious way. There are parts of the country where the sort of gun rights culture has shifted even further to a kind of radical extremist position. And I think it just goes to show how deeply divided America is over this issue. Although it's interesting when you start to look at how this issue plays out in terms of American culture. You know, one of the obvious things that you see is that in places where the Confederacy was, you know, where you had Southern slavery, you see a very strong gun rights culture. You see very lax gun laws. You see very high levels of gun violence, and you see a lot of militant reaction to the idea of common sense gun regulation. And, you know, parts of what we used to call the Wild West, you sort of see a similar kind of gun culture, although the reality in those places was that they actually had some quite strict gun control in places like Dodge City that, you know, the myth of the West has somewhat clouded over. But even in places like Arizona and Colorado, you have seen some movement on this issue. So I think it still remains to be seen whether or not we'll get universal background checks. It's hard to imagine how anyone could oppose it, but you know what goes on in the mind of Senator Paul and Senator Cruz, you know, is anyone's guess. They don't seem to live in the same rational universe that the rest of us live in. But clearly, other places, Colorado, New York, Connecticut, will act soon. We are going to see some improvement in the kind of regulatory scheme. So I think it just shows you what a complicated country America is.
Well, obviously the president is deeply frustrated, and he was quite passionate, saying that we've cried enough, we've known enough heartbreak, what we're proposing is not radical. I'm not taking away anyone's gun rights. It's something that if we are serious, we will do. Now's the time to turn that heartbreak into something real. Now, obviously already Harry Reid has rolled over and taken out the assault weapons ban in the Senate bill. So to that extent, the president's already suffered a loss. I don't know how much he thought it had a prayer, but still, what's your sense of what Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, is doing in terms of basically putting these ads in states and in TV markets where these wavering senators and congressmen are?
Well, of course, it remains to be seen. So far, he's had a pretty good track record, and of course, he is very smart, and he is very politically savvy, and he has considerable resources. What's interesting is we have the sort of perverse incentives of American politics, where if we just put it up to some kind of plebiscite and voted, we would get background checks tomorrow. But because of the structure of interest politics, both in terms of money and the fact that the most radical voices dominate the debate and show up at legislative hearings and bombard people with emails and letters and phone calls, we've got perverse incentives that seem to pull us away from reason towards the most irrational positions in a debate. And so the interesting question is whether Bloomberg can use his considerable resources to counteract that perverse incentive in the system and get the millions of soccer moms and responsible gun owners and other people who recognize, look, nobody is made safer if you don't go through a background check. I mean, you know, the fact that it just boggles the imagination how any of these senators could even propose filibustering background checks. I mean, you know, just listening to Senator Cruz during the Senate hearings, I mean, he is clearly a very arrogant and somewhat pompous and really not very well informed commentator on the Second Amendment. I mean, you know, pretty much everything that comes out of his mouth is out of the Federalist Society playbook. He clearly hasn't, you know, done any serious digging into the issue in terms of what the history and what the law related to the Second Amendment is. But, you know, he spouts this pre-digested pablum that we've gotten from, Cato Institute and Federal Society and these other agents of sort of radicalizing and weaponizing the Second Amendment for this radical agenda. So, I just don't understand how he can, you know, face his family, you know, or look in the mirror in the morning and argue against background checks. I mean, it really is insane.
Well, I don't understand why the proponents of gun control, and perhaps Mayor Bloomberg will do this with his deep pockets, start an offensive that points out that the NRA in its current form, because after all, it wasn't long ago that it was in favor of background checks, is in fact, you know, not protecting the legitimate rights of the legal rights of ordinary law-abiding Americans to own guns, which is the mantra that they put out. What they're doing effectively is protecting criminals. They're protecting gun owners who can sell any numbers of assault weapons to Mexican crime organizations and ship them into Mexico or ship them into inner cities. We know that only a small number of gun stores are responsible for shipping arms and selling arms that end up in the inner cities. We know that the Tired Amendment that the NRA put through one of their stooges in the House effectively prevents law enforcement from sharing data on crime guns. These are guns that already kill people. The DNA behind that gun isn't important to know, but no, you can't even share. Law enforcement can't even share it. It's insane. And haven't they slipped something into the latest funding bill?
Yes, it's quite remarkable that that they've managed once again to sort of sneak something in that essentially will handicap ATF's ability to require gun stores to do inventories, which again is kind of an absurd thing. You expect a store? How could any? I mean, it's the first thing you learn in undergraduate business courses. You need to do an inventory to know what's moving and what's not moving, and to make sure that things haven't been stolen or lost. And yet, you know, if you want to sell things under the table, obviously doing inventories is not a very good idea, which is clearly what's behind this. I mean, basically, the NRA is both a membership organization that stokes kind of the worst kind of paranoid fantasies and fears of the gun rights community, but it's also, you know, an effective agent of the gun industry, and its goal is to sell as many guns as possible with as few strings attached. And, you know, it's just astonishing that we live in a country where something that even NRA members favor somehow can't get passed, which is to say universal background checks.
Again, I'm speaking with Saul Cornell, who's the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect?, and the forthcoming book, The Second Amendment Goes to Court. He is the Paul and Diane Gunter Chair in American History at Fordham University. Now, what about the idea of going on the offensive and not sort of rolling over like Harry Reid's done on the assault weapons ban by taking it out? Obviously, he's upset Senator Feinstein, who, by the way, was the person that Ted Cruz was lecturing in a condescending way, and she managed to, I think, ream him fairly successfully. But I don't know whether the facts matter with these people. But I think with a lot of people in the United States, if they really got the true facts about what the NRA is really, who they're really protecting, you know, not law-abiding citizens, but criminals. That's, I think, an unassailable fact, isn't it?
Well, I think there's no question that the weakening and preventing these common sense regulations can only benefit criminals and the gun industry and not the typical law-abiding citizen. And it is astonishing that the NRA can do things like, after Newtown, still manage to get back to its old tricks of sneaking, you know, unrelated gun rights bills into bills that have nothing to do with firearms. I mean, but of course, part of the problem is a deeper structural problem, is which we there are a lot of people who think that maybe our constitutional system needs some procedural overhauls, because the idea that you can sneak things into these huge bills, which happens on a variety of not just guns but other kinds of issues. I mean, you know, I think that would have shocked the Founding Fathers, because if you look at the average bill that was passed in the 18th century, there was nothing like these 1,000-page bills that we see today. You know, most statutes were fairly short, and, you know, maybe we ought to have an amendment that says no statute can be longer than a page, and if you have to do something complicated, you better pass a whole bunch of statutes.
Well, it's still, I think, hard to understand why the majority gets thwarted in many ways in the country. And that's obviously the use of the filibuster is entrenched. And here you have a president who won handily, and yet he's not able to govern. I mean, he's got to beg and plead and push the emotional buttons that he did today. I find it extraordinary.
Well, it is extraordinary. And part of the reason is I don't think that people on the gun regulation side, gun violence prevention side, have been willing to exact a political price for these measures. You know, there's a lot of agricultural subsidy bills in some of these pro-gun states that could get held up, could be held hostage in exchange for some moderation on the gun issue. And I think, you know, maybe we'll see some movement in that direction, because until the voice of reason are willing to play hardball, we're not going to – obviously, reason is not going to convince these people. So the only thing that will convince them is, I suppose, to use an appropriate metaphor, hold a gun to their head.
Well, but the thing that I find particularly obscene about what happens when you have these extraordinary massacres like Newtown, that it was so hideous because it involved young children – and you keep wondering, is there some kind of, you know, compassion fatigue in this country? Is there some kind of moral numbness that's happened? Because the people who were so deeply outraged haven't been able to translate their outrage into political action. But meanwhile, the NRA has made money out of Newtown. They have got more members, and they're making more money. They thrive on these massacres.
Because of course, many firearms manufacturers also donate money to the NRA when they sell a firearm,
Right, but the firearms people also get rewarded every time there's a massacre,
right,
because people rush out to buy more guns and the NRA pumps up the paranoia that Obama's going to take your guns away, and they trip over each other to buy guns, and in fact they ran out of ammunition recently. So that's the asymmetry that I can't get my head around.
Well, I must confess, here in Connecticut, it is quite remarkable. So looking at some of the kind of public hearings, it's very clear that gun rights people, for reasons that I still find amazing, never seem to have jobs that prevent them from showing up in the middle of the day to testify. We know that the gun manufacturers literally let their employees off and hired buses to bus them to the Capitol to testify. The peace lobby and the peace industry doesn't seem to have nearly the same resources. But the polling data consistently shows that we're talking about a very small minority. And I'm going to an open town meeting tonight in my own town, which is quite near Newtown, Connecticut. And it'll be curious to see what the representatives who have before Newtown clearly aligned themselves with a sort of pro-gun rights position, whether they will have changed at all. After listening to countless, polls and going to public meetings where people have spoken passionately about this issue, I'm looking forward to seeing what happens tonight. It'll be a real eye opener for me to see whether or not, even here in Connecticut, one town over from Newtown, we can have shifted the debate in the direction of reason, moderation, and sensible gun regulation.
Well, just in closing, Saul Cornell, is there a possibility that we can introduce into this debate that doesn't seem to be going anywhere the obvious fact that so many of these misfits, these tortured kids that perpetrate these massacres, are influenced by the cultural influences from Hollywood, et cetera, that basically tell you that, you know, if you got a big gun, you're a big man and you can solve your problems. And even in testimony after Newtown, the right wingers put up some crazy woman who argued that women needed assault rifles in the home because when a burglar or an intruder came in, they would be scared off by these big Arnold Schwarzenegger-like weapons. I mean, the whole
debate.
But of course,
the great thing about that is Senator from Ryland pointed out that the story she told involved not an assault weapon, but an old-fashioned shotgun,
right,
which, of course, nobody's talking about taking away. And she actually hadn't even bothered to figure out what gun was used in the story she was telling before Congress,
right,
which is just astonishing in terms of, what a buffoon, go before Congress, tell this great tale, and then not even bother to check the most basic facts. But typical of what happens, I think, in this very ideologically charged, I've listened to a lot of these public hearings and debates, and I would say, more often than not, what you hear is mythology and paranoia. You don't really hear reasonable analysis, well-researched studies. What you hear is stuff downloaded from the internet that nobody's bothered to check. And, that's not a very good way to make public policy. I mean,
But what I was going to get at, though, Saul, was the idea that maybe we should teach our young boys and young men that guns are instruments of cowardice, that this is not something that makes you a man. It makes you a coward. I've mentioned before that I grew up in Australia, where if you introduce a gun or a knife into a fight, because it's a country of manly men, as you probably know, you're considered an abject coward. So I'm just thinking that maybe we should try and change the culture away from, and particularly here in Hollywood, away from celebrating guns as instruments of heroism and making them instruments of shame.
Well, it's an interesting idea. I don't know how many tickets you'll sell, unfortunately, which is, the bottom line in Hollywood. But, just even much less ambitious things, like pointing out that, in many, many instances, bringing a gun into your home puts you at greater risk, not less risk, of gun violence. And obviously there are many people who have guns in their homes and they can store them safely, and the guns are unlikely to be used for ill purpose. But if you look at some of the statistics, some of the research that's been done at Harvard School of Public Health, You know, the rates of mental illness and the rates of attempted suicide between high-gun states and low-gun states are actually very similar. What's astonishingly different, you know, orders of magnitude 4 or 5 times as high, is the rate of successful suicides in high-gun states. So, you know, little things like saying, you know, you have your Second Amendment rights, but if there's somebody in your house who's seriously depressed, get the guns out at least until they've stabilized, because you're putting them at risk. Having the gun in that house is really going to make you much less safe than safe. And, you know, if we could maybe start with a few clear, obvious cases like that, we can begin to make some progress.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Saul Cornell.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to talk.
Again, I've been speaking with Saul Cornell, who's the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect?, and the forthcoming book, The Second Amendment Goes to Court. He is the Paul and Diane Gunter Chair in American History at Fordham University. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the Saudis are recruiting young jihadis to fight in Syria. Is a warm gun. Happiness is a warm gun, mama. When I hold you in my arms and I feel my finger on your trigger, I know nobody can do me no harm. But it won't be long. Kids with guns, kids with guns. Easy does it, easy does it. They got something to say. Now they're turning us into monsters, turning us into fire, turning us into monsters. It's all. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rhys Ehrlich, a veteran foreign correspondent who reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East Crisis, and most recently, Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. He has an article at Global Post, Saudi Youth Fighting Against Assad Regime in Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rhys Ehrlich.
A real pleasure to be here, Ian.
And this, of course, is we've seen this movie before where these repressive regimes in the Middle East, whether they're military dictatorships or corrupt monarchies, they ship their dissidents off, to Afghanistan. The Egyptian dictators, the Moroccan dictators, they emptied their jails and the CIA and the Pakistani ISI welcomed these freedom fighters, the Mujahideen, and of course we suffered the blowback eventually with Al Qaeda. So I suppose it's not a surprise, but it's still pretty brazen, isn't it? In this day and age, to be doing the same thing, where if you're a young dissident in Saudi Arabia and you get arrested by the police, you basically offered a ticket out of jail if you go and fight in Syria.
Yeah, it's pretty brazen, and I guess unless you're authorities in Saudi Arabia, in which case it's just common sense. My story, I reported from Saudi Arabia and from sources inside Syria. The most serious part of it is that the people who are going are not just going to join whatever democratic-minded group they might be able to find in Syria. They're going to join the most extremist of their factions over there, al-Nusra and some similar groups. And they do it out of ideological solidarity, if you will. And it's running directly counter to the at least ostensible U.S. policies in Syria, which is to oppose those kind of groups. So here an alleged U.S. ally is funding and arming people who are fighting against the goals of the rebellion in Syria.
Well, I think duplicity is no surprise when it comes to Saudi Arabia. I mean, for example, the Saudi king was apparently during the Mubarak period before he was toppled. He was on the phone every day screaming at Obama to shoot the kids in Tahrir Square, and then the Saudis funded the Salafists in the parliamentary elections, and they came out of nowhere and came in second place. Somewhere or other, our government doesn't seem to notice this duplicity or be prepared to do anything about it. But tell us about this extraordinary case of this young Saudi who was arrested for anti-government activities, and then the judge took him into chambers along with, I think 19 of young dissidents altogether, and they were basically encouraged to go and fight the jihad in Syria. And then it took his father to sue the authorities when he learned that his son had died in Syria?
Yes, this took place in a city in northern Saudi Arabia towards the end of last year, and it's a documented case because the father was so outraged about what happened to his 19-year-old son that he wrote a letter of complaint to the king about the judge and the activities of the judge. And surprisingly, he hasn't heard anything back from the king about it. But that appears to be the tip of the iceberg. There have been other reports of people allowed to leave jail, other reports of people being encouraged to go, or wealthy Saudis funding groups of people. So far, it's in the hundreds. And it hasn't reached anything close to what it was like with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, but it's quite troubling nonetheless.
But, Rees Ulick, there's also this pattern, is there not, with wealthy Saudis operating as cutouts or surrogates for the Saudi government? The Saudi government can complain,
sure,
say to the American government, we're not doing this, but this is just volunteer.
Right. And that's exactly the argument of the Saudi government. I interviewed officials with the Saudi government, and they say it's absolutely illegal for people to go and fight in Syria. We forbid it. Our highest leading mullah has issued a fatwa against it. But we can't control what people do if they leave the country as tourists. And if they go to Istanbul and then make their way to the Syrian border, there's nothing we can do about it. So it leaves a rather wide loophole. And, of course, if nothing goes on in Saudi Arabia at this level without at least the tacit government approval. So if you're wealthy, and this is, by the way, not just only in Saudi Arabia, but in Libya and Tunisia and other parts of the Middle East, there's these jihadists flocking to Syria and specifically not fighting at home for democracy or for human rights.
Again, I'm speaking with Rees Ulick, a veteran foreign correspondent who reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy, and The Middle East Crisis, and most recently, Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. He has an article at The Global Post, Saudi Youth Fighting Against Assad Regime in Syria. Now, apparently, quite a lot of arms are now suddenly funneled to the opposition, and mostly by the Saudis and the Qataris. The CIA has a presence in there, and they're supposedly training the Free Syrian Army in Jordan. But apparently these big Russian-made MLRS and Hurricane launchers capable of firing batteries of 220-millimeter rockets the Shmurs, et cetera, they're apparently showing up, and there's a substantial battle going on over the Nirab air base at the Aleppo's airport, where a lot of Russian and Iranian cargo planes are bringing in arms around the clocks. So there's a quantitative change that's going on. But my understanding is that at the summit, the Arab summit that just was underway in Doha, Qatar, there's been some friction between the Saudis and the Qataris. It's nothing new about that. But
yeah,
what's going on?
Well, the Qataris back the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood, as your listeners probably know, is a conservative Islamist group. But in the case of the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, they are committed to a parliamentary system, to holding some kind of elections, to having their right to have some kind of free press and organized trade unions, etc. At least that's what they say. The that's too much for the Saudis. They would prefer to have a military guy come in and impose a new dictatorship. My sources in Saudi Arabia told me that their model is what happened in Yemen, where you had the old dictator thrown out, but a new dictator come in who came in from the military. The problem with that, of course, is it's not going to work in Syria. There's nobody in the Syrian military who's defected or has the capability of doing something like that. So the Saudis, as a backup, go to these more extremist groups, Salafists, whatever you want to call them, people who believe not in a parliamentary system, but in a system of a caliphate, where an Islamic dictatorship would be imposed on the country. Elections are not held, et cetera, et cetera. And it's rule. You have something like the old Ottoman Empire or the old Arab empires of old. And so the Saudis are pushing that those factions, and the Qataris are pushing the Muslim Brotherhood, as is the Turkish government. And that's a point of friction. They all want to get rid of Assad. But once Assad is gone, then we're going to see the real infighting going on amongst these various factions.
Well, there's already been some incidents of the Farouk Brigade's leader. One of them was shot by the al-Nusra people. So
yes.
I guess what's happening now is sort of round one, right?
It is indeed. And these folks are really sectarian. It's like my way or the highway here. For those people involved in the social movements in the U.S., and you've seen some groups act in a really sectarian way, well, imagine if those people had Kalashnikovs. Oh, boy. Anyway, the good news in Syria is that while these extremist groups have been picking up strength, and particularly when they receive arms, they have a certain amount of success because they are fighting the Assad government, they do not have much political support. Groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, like the civil society groups, have a much larger popular base. And if there is ever a chance to hold some free elections, or something close to free elections anyway, I think these groups are going to show that they don't have much popular support.
So is there any pushback coming from the U.S. government against what the Saudis are doing? And if the Turks and the Qataris both want the Muslim Brotherhood, and yet, from my understanding, is these arms that the Saudis are getting from the Balkans are coming by road through Turkey, and that that Prince Bandar, the head of Saudi intelligence, apparently basically had to threaten the Turks, you know, that we buy an awful lot of your stuff, you know. Is that what's going on, just a raw black?
There's a lot of backstabbing and lying to each other. Right. Everybody claimed, the official Saudi line, the official U.S. line, the official Turkish line is we are backing the moderate and nationalist forces. You'll see that in New York Times articles recently that are based out of Washington. The problem is they're simply lying about it, and the U.S. knows that the Saudis are lying about it. I've talked to sources in Washington. But there's all kinds of other reasons that they're not going to go after the Saudis on this one. You know, there's the oil, of course. There's the general political support that they need from the Saudis in the region, and so on and so forth. So the U.S. knows what the Saudis are up to, but they're not going to make an issue out of it, at least so far.
Even though if you really did an inventory of the history of the price that the U.S. has paid for Saudi duplicity, you've got who the Saudis helped create the Taliban. They've radicalized.
They had 19 of the people who attacked on 9/11.
Right, I was about to say
hijackers, not
right.
Minor detail.
And then, of course, they've radicalized Pakistan, and now they're trying to turn Syria into the Somalia of the Mediterranean. You know,
if I was sitting in the State Department, you would have just convinced me, and I would have shifted U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia. But for some reason, the people in Washington ain't changing. They're sticking with Saudis just like they stick with Israel, and there's all kinds of larger economic, political, geostrategic, military factors at play, and they're willing to tolerate this stuff in order to keep the oil flowing and so on.
And not to mention that the Saudis, through the Wahhabis, have succeeded in foisting a kind of extremely conservative and austere version of Islam all around the world.
They back the most extremist forces who they're not interested in even the pretense of democracy. I mean, they, to them, elections is a bad idea.
Sure. Well, you've got this father whose 19-year-old son was killed in Syria. The best he can do is write a letter to the king. That's all you can do in Saudi Arabia.
That's right.
That's Saudi democracy.
Yep.
So what's your sense then of how long this agony is going to go on? Because this, the key air base that I mentioned in Aleppo, we could end up with both. I know the Iranians are already in there, the IRGC, but isn't it possible that the Free Syrian Army and maybe even the Russians are going to be going at it soon? Or what's your?
Well, I think it's still a surrogate war. First of all, nobody knows for sure. You know, we're going off press reports, all of which have their own biases. I've heard no credible reports that the Iranians have large numbers of troops in Syria. They have advisors, they have people working with the intelligence services, etc. Mm-hmm. Hezbollah has some fighters there. I don't think the Russians are going to send in troops. That would be just crazy. If anything, they're trying to back away a little bit from Assad. The Turks are not going to send in their troops. Everyone prefers to use proxies. And so we're going to see fighting mainly among Syrians with some hundreds of foreign fighters involved on one side or the other. I was in Syria in 2011, about 6 months after the uprising began, and people were telling me it was just a matter of months before Assad would be out of power. And here we are over 2 years later. I think the Syrian government has proven to have more support than people had anticipated.
Sure.
And he's played the religion card and he's played the ethnic card
and the foreign interference card, etc.
And the foreign interference card.
Right.
Foreign interference.
Yeah.
which makes people quite angry.
Right. Well,
we've
run out of time, and I thank you so much for joining us, Reese Ehrlich.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Reese Ehrlich, veteran correspondent who reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis, and most recently, Conversations with Terrorist Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. He has an article at the Global Post, Saudi Youth Fighting Against Assad Regime in Syria. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the reversal of democracy in Thailand, Venezuela, the Philippines, Taiwan, and Russia.
So if you want me off your back, well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble.
Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all. It's coming from the silence on the dock of the bay, from the brave, the bold, the battered heart of Chevrolet. Democracy has come to the USA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Joshua Kalancic, who is a fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. Previously, he was a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a fellow at the University of Southern California Center on Public Diplomacy, and a fellow at the Pacific Council on International Policy. He's also served as a columnist for Time, a special correspondent for The New Republic, a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, and a contributing writer to Mother Jones. He's the author of Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Transforming the World, and his latest book just out is Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Kalancic.
Thanks so much for having me.
And your book is a wake-up call in as much as even the middle class, which has traditionally been the bulwark of democracy, is turning against democracy in such places as Thailand, Venezuela, Pakistan, the Philippines, and Taiwan. But I think in terms of the news, if you will, nothing is more obvious than what is happening in Russia now, where Putin has gone after the NGOs, 2,000 of them are being harassed, and of course he's now brought up some trumped-up embezzlement charges against leading opposition leader Alexei Navalny. These charges, of course, were thrown out earlier by another trumped-up court case. So let's start with Russia. What's happening there in terms of a reversal of democracy, in terms of what you're suggesting in your book? Because it seems so much easier just to sort of lay it all at Putin's feet.
Well, I mean, I think that there is an element in which leadership matters. It was theoretically possible that after Yeltsin stepped down, you could have had a different leader who was more committed to the democratic process than Putin. So leadership is a factor, but also I think you had in the 90s a high degree of disillusionment among middle class and elite people and others in Russia with the weak economic growth, fluctuating economy. Russia almost went bankrupt. And even though it's not necessarily the fault of democracy that Russia had such economic problems, the fault was placed at the feet of democracy. And so Putin took advantage of that somewhat, and he promised a kind of stability, and he most of all promised economic growth, which he's been able to deliver largely because of relatively high oil and gas prices. And he combined that with a strong appeal to nationalism, a strong appeal to aligning himself with the Orthodox Church. You might have seen, for example, that there's now even a revival of Cossacks, which, you know, have a negative term to many people in the U.S., but have a mixed lineage in Russia. But when it comes down to it, there have been a lot of protest movements in Russia, but yet they've really been unable to sort of grab the broader middle class there. And I think that that's suggestive of the fact that the middle class is still pretty happy with Putin and happy with, or happy perhaps not the right word, but satisfied enough with Putin and what he has delivered that they don't want to go back to what they saw as a democratic failure in the 1990s.
Well, certainly the collapse of the ruble was a traumatic effect, and that was the early days of post communism, early capitalism, and it certainly was not a particularly happy harbinger of things to come. And I believe that that is deeply rooted. That's considered the great trauma. However, the fact that Putin has been able to shut down all of the media and essentially keep the people in a cocoon of ignorance about the rest of the world and about those that are advocating for democracy, they can take to the streets, but they can barely get their voices heard except online, and he's going after them online. So, and similar things are happening now in Venezuela, where the Chavistas have closed down all of the opposition media, including Globovision, which was the last voice of the opposition, having closed down other opposition television networks earlier. So it seems to me that that is pretty hard to, I mean, how can you not connect a free press with democracy?
No, certainly that's true. I mean, Putin hasn't been able to shut everything down because he can't completely control the internet. But certainly you have a problem that I talk about in the book that's similar with Chavez, Putin, and some others I talk about, like Thaksin Shinawat, who was the prime minister of Thailand, in that they've tended to view democracy as solely being elected. And if you get elected, they view it as their right, their province, to basically ignore all the other facets of democracy, which we would call the constitutional facets. So that, you know, that means protections of the right of the free press, the freedom of religion, protection of private property, social freedoms, the right to have what we call, you know, a loyal opposition. In other words, there should be essentially an opposition party, and it's not treasonous to have an opposition party. And so they come to define democracy as just votes. And some of those votes are relatively free. Like, I do genuinely believe that Chavez, although the elections were not conducted in the freest environment in the world, I think in the freest environment he still would have won, but he had no regard for the rest of the elements of democracy, like a free press. And so in the book I call these type of people elected autocrats. I think you could put other people in the sort of the same version to some extent. Even someone in as wealthy a country as Italy, I would put Berlusconi almost in the same category. So certainly, that's a problem. You have a number of these places where democracy was looked at as an elections and other institutions weren't built that strongly. And so when a leader came along who was both popular and disregarding of the other institutions, those other institutions, courts, the press, et cetera, weren't strong enough to stop him.
Again, I'm speaking with Joshua Kalancic, who is a fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's also been a columnist for Time, a special correspondent for The New Republic, a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, and a contributing writer to Mother Jones, and his latest book just out is Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government. So the idea that these autocrats get elected and they believe in democracy in terms of the election that elects them or re-elects them, but they don't believe in democracy when they're voted out, and they don't provide the voters with that opportunity to vote them out. And that's always been attributed in many ways to the Islamists, the idea that in the Islamic world, democracy means one vote, one time. So how much does Mohamed Morsi fit into that mold?
Well, just to go back, I don't actually agree with that. I mean, I don't think that all of the people that I would put into the category of elected autocrats believe that if they were voted out, they shouldn't step down. That would make them truly not even elected autocrats. Then they would be in the category of just an autocrat, like Ethiopia, North Korea, Saddam Hussein, etc. Berlusconi was voted out, and although he has now returned to politics, he did leave when he was voted out. And other people that I talk about in the book, like including Thaksin and his party, I think were they voted out, they would leave. The problem that you also run into that I talk about in the book is a lot of times opponents of these elected autocrats have not chosen elections that are democratic means to try to oust them. So Chavez's opponents tried to coup. Well, that's not going to help. Thaksin's opponents tried to coup. Succeeded. So again, that doesn't contribute. I don't really believe also that there's something inherent in Islam that is counters the possibility of democracy. There are a number of countries with Muslim majorities or large Muslim populations that are vibrant democracies. I think that it's a little too soon to tell about who Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood are. They could be autocrats. They could evolve into something more like you have in Turkey. They're certainly picking up the remnants of an ossified, messed up in many ways, authoritarian system. But I don't think that Islam is any more conducive to autocracy than anything else.
Well, Joshua Kalancic, though, it does seem that there's a connection between those with autocratic tendencies in democracies and the control of the media. I mean, Berlusconi essentially controlled much of, if not most, of the Italian media. Thaksin in Thailand, wasn't he a big media mogul as well?
Yes, I do think that there's a connection, and the connection is that they don't believe in, like I said, they don't believe that in other forms of democracy and other aspects, including freedom of the press, so they buy up a large percentage of the media. I mean, I don't think that is always true. You don't necessarily have to buy it up. Like in Sri Lanka, the government has just cowed the media, but buying up the media is certainly one way you could do it.
Yeah, well, that's what's just happened in Venezuela now, that the Chavistas have managed to close down Globovision by essentially buying the guy out. And he was the last and the only voice of the opposition. And Putin, I suppose, did Berezovsky get paid for the television networks that Putin took over?
I think he just got exiled. I think that still, that's certainly a significant element. I think many of these people you're talking about are genuinely popular, particularly with middle class and lower class people. Thaksin, for example, won his first election. His party has won every election. Thailand has a relatively free media now. Thaksin is not in control of the media. There is actually quite a lot of opposition to him, and yet they still have continued to win elections. His sister is currently the prime minister. So I think you have a combination of some genuine popularity, leaders with little regard for most elements of democracy, and, you know, in some of these cases at least, control of the media. But in Thailand, for example, the media is not an echo chamber for Thaksin by any means.
So just applying your research, Joshua Kalancic, in your new book, Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government, it hasn't happened here. For example, Rupert Murdoch hasn't been able to take over in the United States, but he certainly did through an emissary, according to Bob Woodward, in a tape that he released through the Washington Post style pages of all places, an extraordinary conversation with an emissary from Roger Ailes to General Petraeus, offering him the presidency on a plate. All he had to do was sign on the dotted line. So where do we stand here in the United States in terms of your overall picture that you're presenting in your new book?
Well, the book doesn't look specifically the United States because there's really significant differences between the United States and any other Western industrialized democracy and some of these countries. So I tried to look at the reversals in lower and middle income countries, but certainly I think the United States has major governance challenges now. No one follows the news doesn't know that. I think that the U.S. has problems of media consolidation, but you know, I think that the constitutional checks and the institutions that are weak in places like Venezuela or Thailand or even Italy are much stronger in the U.S. I mean, I think that the fact that a guy was elected president in 2000 without the popular vote was highly disputed. Many people thought the Supreme Court ruling was almost farcical because it was a one-time ruling only. But, you know, that opposition was expressed in protests, in discussion in the media. There was nothing like in Thailand or Venezuela or the Philippines. There was no military coup. There was no street protest designed to push Bush out of office. I think that the constitutional system still works. So that's one thing, difference between a more established democracy. And that doesn't have to be only the U.S. I mean, I think that would be true in Germany. That would be true in Sweden. That would be true in India. Secondly, you know, I think that the media consolidation in the U.S. is less to do with control by one person who has political aims, as you've seen in some of these places, than a failure of regulators to prevent consolidation, which allows for greater profit by media companies. I don't think it's anywhere comparable to Berlusconi, Thaksin, an earlier Thaksin, at least, Chavez, something like that. And, you know, I think also the types of media have expanded enough. I mean, that it's unclear whether even these media companies that are so dominant are still going to be so dominant some period in the future from now. So I think the U.S. has certainly got a lot of challenges, but I'm not concerned that democracy is going to fail in the United States.
Well, I was actually thinking also in terms of the notion that the middle class, the normal bulwark for democracy, and you're suggesting in your new book, Joshua Kilancic, Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government, that in many ways the U.S.'s foreign policy is predicated upon the assumption that the middle class undergirds democracy. And I would be interested in the figures of who votes in these countries we're talking about, where autocrats have taken over democratically and have closed off the opposition. I think in Russia, probably more people vote. In Venezuela, I'm sure more people vote than they do in the United States. I mean, we have a voluntary abdication in this country, and I don't know how much of that is attributed to the middle class, but what at the very best, about 60% of the population votes.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true. I don't know. It would be hard to draw direct comparisons in some of these cases because some of these countries have mandatory voting. So, but, yeah, certainly one of the problems you have in the U.S. is that people opted out of the political system. And it's a similar disillusionment, perhaps, in some of these other countries. All I'm saying is that the means available to people who are disillusioned, and I do think there's a lot of disillusionment in the U.S., and obviously that's given rise to a lot of different things, including the Occupy movement, the Tea Party movement, and all sorts of different things. I just think that with, you know, some very minor exceptions, the means available to people who are disillusioned with democracy in the United States to change the system are not the same means as, for example, a middle-class or elite person in Thailand who was able to sort of go along with a coup 6 years ago. So I think the disillusionment in the United States is high, but I don't think that, and I think it's bad for the democratic process. I don't think it means that the democracy itself is in under threat, I guess I would say, in the United States the way it is in some places in Southeast Asia, in Russia, even in some places, I think, in Southern Europe, like Greece and Italy.
So just in closing then, Jessica Lansick, what would reverse this trend short of more media transparency? And we mentioned Russia, for example, that Putin has not yet managed to take over the internet, but you know the rest of the media spectrum is kind of Putin worship and United Russia worship, as is the case in all of these other countries, particularly now in Venezuela. So I've done coverage on net neutrality, as it's called, rather inadequately here. So there's concern that even our own internet could be corporatized. So is that our great hope?
Media transparency, or
yeah, sorry,
again, I don't think that necessarily corporatized, and what you saw with Berlusconi and Putin is the same thing. I'm not, but no, I mean, I think there are a lot of aspects. For one, I think that just as in these countries, leaders have tended to define elections as the only facet of democracy. Too often, you know, more industrialized democracies, the U.S., Europe, Canada, Japan. All the big players who would sort of sanction the way we talk about sanctions with Iraq, but who would say that a country is on the right path, have tended to also just view elections as the arbiter of whether a country is making a democratic process. And I think we need to step back from that and look at a broader, fuller conception of democracy. Secondly, I think, you know, we have too often ignored democratic reversals. Thailand is a good example. After the coup in 2006, the U.S. really didn't do anything. I mean, we have some laws that Congress has on the books that require that when a country has a coup, we cut off some types of aid, but we did as little as we could, and basically the relationship continued. So that's another. I think also in the countries themselves, you know, you need not only effective leadership, but that leadership, let's say in a good case, like Nelson Mandela in the post-apartheid era, the leadership not only was able to draw on the great support of mostly poor people, but also sort of placate the concerns of middle classes and elites who, whether you like it or not, often are in control of a lot of the capital and the media. And then finally, I think that in a number of these places, the leadership, and you know, the U.S. has a role to play in this too, but needs to probably de-link the idea that democracy is going to bring staggering economic growth, at least at first, because then you're setting people up for a disappointment. And I think a sort of playing down of the expectations of the link between the two is important. They both need to be evaluated on their own merits, I think.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Joshua Kalansik. I think we barely scratched the surface, so maybe we should talk again, but I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Joshua Kalansik, who's a fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a fellow at the University of Southern California Center on Public Diplomacy, and a fellow at the Pacific Council on International Policy. He's also served as a columnist for Time, a special correspondent for The New Republic, a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, and a contributing writer for Mother Jones. He's the author of Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Transforming the World, and his latest book just out is Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. Bye for now.